Matthew 23, verses 1 through 4. Matthew 23, 1 through 4. Then Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do. But do not do according to their works, for they say and do not do. For they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders. But they themselves will not move with them with one of their fingers."
Good morning. We're going to have to move pretty hurriedly today. Our text is going to come from Matthew 23, and I couldn't find a place to stop. So we're going to cover a lot of Matthew 23 because it just all flows together. And I've got a lot of points to carry through and just the same amount of time to get there as normal. So that's a problem. It could have been worse. I was working on this sermon and really was struggling last night and did what I normally do when I'm stuck on a sermon. I call up Nancy Riggs and I said, "How do you think I ought to cover Matthew 23? And Nancy said, "I can see at least 62 points in this chapter for you to talk about." I said, "Now that's silly. No one would believe 62 points. Half the congregation at least would be disappointed by 62 points, where the other half might like it. I don't know. So I'm going to go with 7, and that's going to be plenty. But if you want the other 62, Nancy will tell you about them if you want to know." There, I made at least half of you like me less. There we go. Matthew 23 is our text, and we're continuing our series on the crimes of Jesus of Nazareth. And I could have made this a really short series. When we want to know what happened to Jesus, when Jesus enters the city of Jerusalem, everybody likes him. By the end of the week, crucify him, crucify him. What crime did Jesus commit to get himself killed? What did he do wrong? What did he do that made so many enemies among people that were seemingly, on the surface at least, content with him at the beginning of the week? Of course, we know that's an oversimplification of what happened, isn't it? But we could have answered this question, what did Jesus do that resulted in his crucifixion, by just simply saying Matthew 23? This series has been an excuse for me to cover all of the last half of the book of Matthew. But really, Matthew 23, in short order, gives you a look at the teachings of Jesus in such a group as to make it clearly evident why he is crucified, why he is lynched before the book is over. The teachings of Jesus are just almost unbearable to his audience, as they ought to be to us today. When we hear these teachings, these are not easy things to be heard. They provoke within the religious anger. In fact, I can't do justice to Matthew 23. If I were to preach it the way he preached it, I'm reading the text, I'm listening to the pacing of the words, I wasn't there to hear it, of course, but if I were to string it together the way I think he must have said it, the way it's written and constructed, the word you would describe it with is rant or diatribe. It is just one accusation after another, after another, after another, none of them blunted, none of them apologetic. Folks, I'm very sorry to say this, but nope. It is cutting wit, places of, I dare say, sarcasm, and it is an angry rejection of what people of his day and ours would term religion. And so if you want to look with us in Matthew 23, if you dare, turn to Matthew chapter 1, or excuse me, Matthew 23, and begin in verse 1. Where Jesus begins to list for us, simply put, the sins of the religious. Matthew 23, 1 through 12. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. So do and observe whatever they tell you, but not the works they do. For they preach, but do not practice. They tie up heavy burdens hard to bear and lay them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger. They do all their deeds to be seen by others, for they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long. And they love the place of honor at feast and the best seats in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces and being called rabbi by others. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher and you are all brothers. And call no man your father on earth, for you have one father who is in heaven. Neither be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Christ. The greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. What are the sins of the religious? Oh, he gets started there in verse 2, and he just doesn't stop. The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Quite literally, in the days of Moses, back long ago, long before Jesus, 1,500 years in the past from these events, there was quite literally a seat. Jesus was the leader of his people. I'm sorry, Moses was the leader of his people, and he sat in judgment, and they would come to him with issues to decide as you go to the wise leader of your people. And he would say, well, this is how the law is interpreted for your situation, and he would teach them the way of God out of the law that he himself had brought down from Mount Sinai. And when he got up out of that seat, the scribes and Pharisees sat down. They said, I think we could just continue that business of telling people how to live their lives. Moses got his authority from the God at the top of the mountain. The scribes, the Pharisees, gave it to themselves. And they sat in the judgment seat of Moses. And they proceeded to say, we pious and wise few will tell you how you can do better. Have we got a sermon for you? And they'd tie up the heavy weights. They'd say, if you're really pious, you'll do this and you'll do that, and here's the list, and we'll find ways to make your life more difficult. These are the same people that see Jesus' disciples coming through a field, picking grains of sand off the head of the wheat, or grains of wheat off the head of the wheat, and eating it, and they say, well, you're farming on the Sabbath, don't you know? Same people who say, well, your master doesn't make your disciples wash their hands the way we do. All kinds of things they found. I mean, how would you even know? How would you even know whether Jesus' disciples washed their hands? Have you thought about that one? They're quite convinced they don't. How would they even know? Because they were watching. Because they were concerned every minute of every day as to whether or not other people were living up to their self-assigned standard. Which means there was one person they were never watching, and it was themselves. Heavy burdens on others but won't lift a finger for themselves is the accusation Jesus makes. He says that they do all their deeds to be seen of others. This is the same rebuke contained in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6, where he points out basically every kind of Jewish discipline and worship and service and says, have you noticed that people do that to be seen? Don't give your alms to be seen of men. Don't pray on the street corner with long words and on and on. Don't fast and look like you're fasting. Why does he make that series of rebukes? This is why. Because their religion had become a religion to be seen of men and glorified by them themselves. Jesus wants there to be glory. Jesus wants to be glory for good works even. Matthew, same sermon. Jesus says, you're a city on the hill. But he thinks your good works ought to glorify God. These people had begun to work works that glorified only themselves. And they were quite happy to have it. They had figured out how to look the part. The broadened phylactery. Right? Phylacteries, are, I guess, are out of fashion, so I can't say a lot about them. But the idea of this special religious garment. When I wear this, I'm especially holy. And I won't just wear it. You might not see it if it's thin. I need a really big one. I need you to know how pious I am. And I need the hem, the fringe of my holy garments to be long. So you see me going long after I've passed. You need to look at me and know how religious I am today. And Jesus says, these are the sins of religious people. And I'm coming to say a word about them. And what he begins here in verse 13 are a series of seven woes, and they are the harshest, the most biting and severe of all the words of Jesus, and I give them to you today to do with as you will. Beginning in verse 13, woe to the gatekeepers. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut the kingdom of heaven in people's faces, for you neither enter yourselves nor allow those who would enter to go in. The Pharisees and the scribes had made themselves gatekeepers. What do we mean by that? They had decided that it was their task to decide who came in and who went, but especially who came in. In an ancient city, you had a wall around it. How do you keep the city safe? You had a gate, and you'd post somebody there to make sure only the right kind of people got into your city. Well, we even have this kind of ritual still today that's a vestige of that. We talk about giving someone the key to the city. Well, we trust you with the key to the city. Where does that come from? The idea that at one time there was quite literally a wall around the city that kept us safe, and there was a gate and there was a key, and we trust you with the key to the city. Right? We don't have the wall anymore. We still give the keys away. Don't ask me why. That's somebody else's choice. But it comes from that, right? Well, the scribes and the Pharisees had decided they were the gatekeepers, and they held the keys. Who put them in that job? Nobody. God had never done it. They called it Moses' seat for a reason. It wasn't theirs. But they had sat themselves down in the place of judgment and decided they would keep the gate, and they would decide what sort of persons would come in. And would you believe it? Nobody lived up to their standards. Their standards were so holy and high that every person that came to the city, they'd close that gate and say, no, not you. Not your sort. The irony of the gatekeeper is that the gatekeeper himself is often on the outside of the gate. And that's what Jesus points in about these folks. He says, you're keeping the gate. You're closing up the kingdom. You won't let anybody else in, and you won't go in yourself. You know who keeps the gates of the city of the kingdom of heaven? It is the Lord our God himself. And it always has been. He's never actually asked us to make ourselves the watchdogs and sentinels of his kingdom, to decide who was worthy to come in and who wasn't. He's never asked that of us. He's asked us to be alert, to be aware, to be sensible, but never to be in the business of deciding who's in and who's out. It's never been our job. And Jesus says, those of you who have taken religion to mean you can set yourself up as the moral authority to judge all people, he says, that was never your job. If you're going to do it, you're going to do it from the outside looking in. Woe to the gatekeepers. Look at verse 15. How about another woe? Woe to the propagandists. I didn't have a good word for this, so I went with propagandists. Verse 15, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. For you travel across sea and land to make a single proselyte. And when he becomes a proselyte, you make him twice as much a child of hell as yourselves. If you asked a Pharisee, he would say, I'm very evangelistic. I'm all in favor of making people what? Servants of God, faithful to God, changed people. What the Jewish proselyte, the Pharisee, was in favor of was making people just like himself. And if you would humble yourself to him and to satisfy his requirements, remember he's the gatekeeper, if you could be good enough with all of the practices he thought were important to make him happy, he would declare you Jewish and you could be just like him. Jesus says, problem is, nobody ought to be like you. And when you travel the world to make people just like you, you make them just what you are, a child of hell and not of heaven. Has he gotten severe yet? He's criticizing their evangelism. I mean, that's a sacred cow. Anything churches do to be evangelistic has to be a good thing. Jesus says, not so much. He says, there's a way to even do that wrong. Notice he doesn't call them evangelist. They don't have any good news to share. He calls them proselytizers. You're adding membership to the role, but you're not changing the hearts and minds of these people any more than you did for yourself. We have to be careful, church, but when we are sharing the gospel, we are sharing the good news of Christ and not spreading the propaganda of our particular ideology and views about how people ought to be more like me. Matthew 23, now look at verses 16 through 22. Some of these get a little lengthier. Woe to the loophole chasers. Woe to you, blind guides, who say, If anyone swears by the temple, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath. You blind fools. For which is greater, the gold or the temple that made the gold sacred? And you say, if anyone swears by the altar, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift that is on the altar, he is bound by his oath. You blind men. For which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? So whoever swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it. And whoever swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And whoever swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. What's the point of that one? This is an interesting one. At first it seems strange to us and foreign, like, well, I've never heard of that. But once you listen to what it is, it's something we do all the time. These folks had found a way to interpret the law so strictly that it created loopholes. This is the irony. This is the irony. They thought they were being so particular it allowed them to be more obedient. But when you interpret the law in a way it was never meant to be interpreted, with a level of precision that it never had, what you actually do is you create little loopholes, the kind you can drive semis through. When you say, God said, this is, again, so similar to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. God said to love your neighbor. So what did they do? They interpreted that very specifically. I'll love my neighbor, which is that guy, and I'll hate everybody else. What did they do? They interpreted, it was God's law, but they interpreted it so specifically, it actually blunted the point of the commandment. The point of the commandment, love your neighbor, wasn't now you can get away with hating everybody else. The point of the commandment, love your neighbor, was to love everybody, to be a loving neighbor, which is how Jesus teaches it. But what did they do? They found a way around that. We'll specify it. We'll make it so specific. And I'm sorry if there are practicing lawyers in the room. I'm going to be mean now. But this is reading the Bible like a lawyer does. And to be fair, we're all part of it because this is what we pay lawyers to do. We go to a lawyer and we say, I think I may have committed a crime. Can you find me a loophole that says I didn't actually? Can you find me a way to justify what I did? And he goes and does what we pay him for. He reads it very specifically if he's not careful. Not all of them do this, but some of them do. And he's going to find a technicality because that's what you asked him to do, especially if you're guilty. If you're innocent, you say, prove it. If you're guilty, you say, find me a loophole. Find a way that I didn't technically do what this book says I did. And that's how people had come to read their law and had subverted the intent of the very law they say they cherished. And so, to tell the truth, well, I have to tell the truth when I swear an oath. In fact, I have to tell the truth when I swear a really good oath. So, this in the medieval era, the Roman Catholic Church engaged in this, and they found ways. I mean, I kid you not, I'm not trying to pick on Catholics today, but I kid you not, in the Roman era, they had found ways to justify from the scriptures priests consorting with prostitutes. And you say, how is that possible? They found ways. Right? That if you read this very specifically and read that very particular and you bend it around, then you can create this loophole that you can drive your truck to. Council of Constance, the church. Council of Constance hired 5,000 prostitutes for a meeting of the clergy at Constance. The church paid the bill. How do you get there? By reading something the way it was never meant to be read. These folks had found a way to make it okay to tell a lie in an oath. As long as you didn't swear by the gold of the temple or the gift on the altar, you could swear by the temple or swear by the altar and tell whatever you wanted to say. They look for a loophole. Here's a crazy idea, Jesus says. How about we tell the truth? How about we do what God intended and stop using our religiosity as a mask for the sins we wanted to get away with in the first place? Woe to the loophole chasers. Verses 23 and following. He's not done. He just keeps on moving. Woe to you. Woe to those who major in minors. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. For you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. You blind guides, straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel. Woe to you who major in minors. Now notice, I want to give the same disclaimer that Jesus himself gives. He says there's no part of what God has said that is unimportant. Okay? He doesn't suggest there's some of this you're supposed to ignore. You are not supposed to ignore any of it. But he says you are blind if you don't realize some of it is more important than others. And I say that, and it's almost, people start pulling their hair out when I say that. How can any part of the Bible be more important than any other part? Because Jesus says it is. He doesn't say any of it is negligible. None of it is unimportant. But some of it is most important. He says it quite often. He can say there is one greatest commandment and everything hangs on it. It's most important of all. Here again, he does the same thing. He doesn't say the other stuff is unimportant. He says, but there are some things you're supposed to get right first. How about justice? How about mercy? These are things that are supposed to matter. Christianity works the same way, folks. There is no part of the New Testament that you're supposed to ignore. But do you understand there are some things that actually are more important? How do I know that? Because Paul said so. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, he's talking about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And he says, I delivered unto you what was of first importance. He says, this comes first. We'll work on everything else second. And there was plenty to work on in Corinth. He says, step one, we need to make sure we're on board with the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Because that matters. Not that any of it doesn't matter. But that matters above all else. Jesus says you have to be very careful about majoring in minors. Spending your attention, your energy, your time, your intellect, your passion on the things that were supposed to always be secondary. And obviously so. Oh, the things we choose to care about in churches. What do things we fight about in churches look like? Have you ever sat down and made a list? Don't do it. It's terribly depressing. Think about your life in churches and all the churches you've ever participated in. Count this one in. And write down the things that people have fought about, complained about, bickered about, split over, hated over, mistreated each other over. See how many times judgment, mercy, and grace end up on that list. See how many times people fight and bicker over love of God and neighbor, the greatest commandment. It's usually not on the list. Or the resurrection of Jesus Christ, usually not on the list. Why do we do ourselves these self-inflicted harms? Jesus says you've majored in minors. You have swallowed the camel and strained at the gnat. Verse 25, woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. He has a woe here to the truly unclean. For you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and the plate, that the outside also may be clean. So think of this very literally to start with, and then move into what he says. Imagine now you've asked your kids to do the dishes, and they take all the dishes and they clean the outside of them. They say, here, Dad, time for dinner. Are you impressed? Are you even hungry anymore? No, this is terrible. This isn't clean. No one in any state of mind thinks that's acceptably clean. But what have we done with our religion? We have found ways to concentrate on the appearance of things rather than the reality. Jesus says it is cleaning the outside of the cup. We have found ways to make ourselves to appear religious when inside we are truly unclean. And that terminology is not accidental. These are the people who worried a lot about what was clean and unclean. Remember my comment earlier? These are the Pharisees who said, your disciples don't wash their hands so they can be clean. They fretted about this stuff. He says, can I tell you a place where you'll find a great deal of uncleanness? Oh, yes, tell us. We'll root it out. We'll find it. We'll clean it up. He says, it's right inside the cup. It is what you are on the inside that has become filthy and in need of washing. Verse 27, woe to those who are dead inside. And this one connects to the last. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. for you are like whitewashed tombs, but which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dead people's bones and all uncleanness. So you also outwardly appear righteous to others, but within are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness." Oh, digging deep on this one. His metaphors get closer and closer to my corrupt heart. He says, "You are the whited sepulcher. You would be happy to garnet these beautiful, beautiful tombstones and these sepulchers that look like these immaculate monuments." He says, "You'd almost make us forget they're all dead inside." He says, "That is what your religion has become. You are the finest, most religious looking people on the face of the earth, but you are dead on the inside. Your holiness is skin deep. Woe to the dead inside." And finally, when we think we've had just about all we can bear, he saves the harshest for last. Woe to the sin denier. In verses 29 through 35, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you build the tombs of the prophets and decorate the monuments of the righteous, saying, 'If we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets.' Thus you witness against yourselves that you are the sons of those who murder the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your fathers, you serpents, you brood of vipers. How are you to escape being sentenced to hell? Therefore I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, some of whom you will kill and crucify, and some you will flog in your synagogues and persecute from town to town, so that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar. Truly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation." What is his final accusation? Please hear this one. At the end of the sermon, he says, "This is the seventh sin you've committed. You listened to this entire sermon and you thought it was about somebody else." Sermons are always popular about other people. You want to be a popular preacher? Can I write you the script? It's easy. Get up every Sunday morning and tell them what everybody else is doing wrong. Preach sin and damnation and hellfire against the world outside, and people will love you for it. They'll sing your praises. "Boy, he preached a fiery sermon this morning." That's what hellfire and brimstone means, right? When we rain it down on the other guys and we say, "Boy, there's some bad folks out there. Glad I'm in here." These Pharisees and scribes and leaders of the people had convinced themselves, "Oh yeah, our forefathers were bad. Why, they killed the prophets. It's a shame God didn't have me back then. If he'd have had me, we'd have done that right." Jesus says, "You want to see what's going to happen when he's got you? You will kill and crucify his prophets, starting with the Son of God. You will scourge them in your houses of worship, the synagogue. You will read the scriptures on Sabbath day and kill the prophets on Monday morning. You will fill up the measure of your fathers. Your greatest sin is thinking this was about your forefathers or those other people out there." Let me suggest to you that this and this point alone is what made the Pharisees, the scribes, the chief priests the angriest with Jesus. Do you understand that they approved of his moral teaching? They agreed with his rebuke of sin toward everybody else. But Jesus had the audacity to say, "The people in the nice religious clothes are the greatest of all in their hypocrisy," and to condemn them along with the rest. This is Matthew 23. They're going to kill him for it a few chapters later. These are the crimes of Jesus of Nazareth. He rebuked us for being religious. Let me suggest then to you today, in the dire warnings of the word of our Lord, I wanted so desperately today to mitigate this and to make it sit easier with you so you could go to lunch and say, "That was a fine sermon," and not hate me quite as much as you do now. I really wanted to be apologetic, and Jesus just wouldn't allow it. In this text, He says, these are the things you are doing inside, and you still think it's somebody else that I'm talking about. Take this Sunday. Look not at your appearance, at the facsimile of Christian religion that you have produced, but look at what is inside. And ask yourself if this is not a sermon preached at me. Now, can I give you the good news? I do get to get in with good news. The chapter ends with Jesus weeping. Jesus is not happy. He doesn't giggle and say, oh, you're all going to burn. This is a compassionate Jesus. The end of the chapter, Jesus says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. How often would I have gathered you in, but you would not? Do you understand that's an invitation? The weeping Lord, who is angered and grieved by your sins, would be much happier to invite you home to Him. To let Him begin the lifelong project of rebuilding you in the image of God from the inside out, not on the outside only. To begin a life truly in His service. Today you have a choice to make. You can hear the woes of Jesus of Nazareth and determine, as they did so long ago, to put Him to death. Crucify Him, crucify Him. Or you can listen to the words of your loving Lord. How much did it cost Him to say these things to you? His life would have been so much easier if He would just be quiet. If He could just not say these words. Why does He say them? Is He naive? Does He not know they're going to kill Him for it? He says it because He loves you that much. To say the words, to prick your heart, even if it cost Him His own life. And it absolutely will. Make the decision today to hear Him as your loving Lord. Respond to Him in faith and begin a life in Him. As we stand and sing a word of encouragement, you may come, and you ought to.